Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live this week from the State Capitol Building in Pierre. The longest-serving Chief Justice in the nation is David Gilbertson from South Dakota. He is right here with me today. Welcome, sir.
Good afternoon.
And he has a gavel that has a claw hammer on it.
I do.
I saw it yesterday. Why don't you tell us real quick what the story behind that was, because that's worth repeating if you didn't see his speech.
I have a friend who I met through church, and he's very handy at making things, and he gave me a hammer, or no, gavel, excuse me, and usually judges' gavels have the cylindrical head. Instead, he had a claw hammer on it because he said he thought judges ought to use their authority as a judge, represented by the gavel, to build things. And so I thought it was very appropriate to point that out when I was talking about expansion of drug and alcohol courts.
Right.
It's in my office, and so every day I see it, it reminds me I should build things.
And that notion of building things in your line of work is maybe counterintuitive to some citizens who interact with the court system on a different level than where you're at.
Well, I think a lot of people have the original view of a court that used to be. In the old days, you'd bring your dispute to the judge would make his or her decision and send the people on their way, and the courts were basically done with it. It doesn't work that way anymore. Times have changed, problems have gotten more complex. You just can't simply lock everybody up and say, well, that problem was solved. So we are much more proactive, be it drug courts, alcohol courts, veterans courts. Problems are not going to solve themselves. The courts are going to have to be proactive and participate in solving them.
So how do you personally, over the years, stay on top of those changes and kind of push them ahead and accept the changes that are good and push back against the ones that you don't want to see? A lot of changes in your career.
There have been. I've been a judge now 30 years in February, so I'm the second senior judge in the state. When I became a judge, you basically, if you had a criminal person in front of you, you had two options. You could either lock them up or you could kind of release them on a probation. And probation oftentimes wasn't effective enough because it wasn't enough supervision. And while you warehoused them in a jail or a penitentiary, if they were alcohol addicted or drug addicted, when they were released, they were still alcoholics or drug addicts. You talk to any judge in the state, they will tell you that that's one of their chief frustrations, is the inability to actually positively change people's lives. And when I heard about a drug court program, which was actually suggested to me by a judge in the Northern Black Hills, I thought, let's try it. And it seemed to work. It was a tough sell at first because everybody thought it was hug a thug or get out of jail free. But it worked. It grew, and the early growth was not easy because there was a lot of suspicion and a lot of people simply didn't understand it. But I think that now it has received acceptance statewide, and we cannot continue to grow our jail population. We cannot continue to construct prisons. Do you want to build a prison, or do you want to build schools? Do you want to expand USD and SDSU, or do you want another women's prison? That's your choice.
So, and you said there's a higher level of accountability for the addict instead of getting locked up,
right,
than to go through one of these programs. Elaborate on that account, the sense of accountability from the perspective of somebody who has the problem and has committed a crime.
Well, if you send them to the prison, they're not really held accountable. Mm-hmm. True, they're locked up and they probably don't want to be there, but they are not supporting their family. They are not working. They are basically costing society money while contributing nothing. If you get them into a drug or alcohol program, they are required to maintain sobriety. They're probably tested at least 2-3 times a day at random. They have to maintain their own home. They have to support their children. And they have to maintain a job or full-time employment. One of the hidden benefits of drug and alcohol court is, and I referenced it yesterday in the State of the Judiciary, there are 588 children of these people who are in drug or alcohol courts. If those folks were in prison, where they would be if they weren't in our programs, those 588 kids would be in the custody of the Department of Social Services, and the taxpayers would pay $10,000 a year per child for each one of those 588 children. If their folks were in the pen versus if they're in drug or alcohol programs, the parents are supporting them. So, I mean, huge savings.
Veterans Court. Tell me more about what that is. That's a relatively new thing. And when I think of a veteran, I don't necessarily think that they're different from anyone else. So why Veterans Court and what is it trying to do?
We found out after 1991, the first Gulf War, that veterans are coming back with various psychological diseases that were different than Vietnam, different than World War II. But there were problems then, too. My mother was a nurse in World War II, surgical nurse overseas, and told me some of the problems she saw when that war ended, the veterans coming home. But we saw these people, these veterans coming back and getting into trouble. Say it was DWI, assaulting a spouse, and oftentimes it was because they were under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both. And what they were really trying to do is self-medicate their mental conditions they brought home with them. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, in a veterans court, if they've come in to our criminal justice system charged with a crime, that we can consider, rather than incarcerating them, if it's not too serious a felony, obviously, if it's murder or rape or something like that, that's a different story. But say it's an assault or something like that, or DWI. Try to get them, let's deal with the underlying problem, the mental problem. And we partner with the VA to do that. And those veterans are entitled to that VA help, but some of them are too proud to ask. They don't know how to ask. They maybe need some assistance. So the court service officer, along with the judge, will identify the person's a veteran and then offer them the opportunity. Instead of going to jail, how about you do the VA inpatient, and the VA will evaluate them and then come up with a treatment program. And it might be beneficial enough where if the veteran completes the program, the charges are dismissed, which is a huge advantage if you're going out looking for a job. Question number one, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Mm-hmm. So,
mentorship in that program with other veterans getting involved, helping you know, veterans who are in trouble?
It will probably, when we roll it out statewide. So far, we only have the program in Watertown. We just had a ceremony in Sioux Falls in December, and my understanding is that program will be up and running as of the first of this year. I would like to grow that program out a lot more than it has been so far, but unlimited budgets, you also are trying to grow drug, alcohol courts, you know, help the elderly. And so we have great hopes for the program and hope we'll be able to expand it in the future.
Right. Let's talk about the elderly you alluded to. And by the way, just as a little pause, yesterday in your speech you mentioned, you quoted Audrey Hepburn, Ben Franklin, I think your father-in-law, mm-hmm. A South Dakotan who had been through one of these courts. So it was a vast array of influences on your speech yesterday. You must be a reader and a thinker as well.
Well, I guess I've always said I've never had an original idea, but I know I know a good one when I see it, and I know how to borrow it.
That's Elder Abuse Task Force. Tell us about that. That's obviously something that's close to you.
It is. It occurred to me that we have a lot more elderly people in South Dakota. We're an aging state. I can remember when I was a young boy, I had a paper route, and my mother, who was a nurse, told me that if there were more than 3 days' papers in a door of an elder person, she wanted to know about it, and she went and checked on them. Well, sadly, that probably isn't the case for most South Dakotans anymore, where your neighbors keep an eye on you. So, and we're living longer. It's not unusual now to live to be 100. And the other thing is that you don't maybe live with your kids anymore, your adult children. They could be living in Philadelphia. So the seniors of today are much more at risk for abuse, either physical abuse, financial abuse, or emotional abuse, than were my parents. And so we are trying to have the state step in. These people built this state. They fought and won World War II. We just saw the Korean vets this week. We owe them, and I think we owe them this amount of protection. And, of course, I have a little self-interest in it because I'm 66 now.
So, and you'll live to be 100, maybe. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Right?
I'd be all for that.
Right. And another thing you mentioned yesterday was the mental health issue, which is coming up for you. You said South Dakota is not keeping up.
Right.
Is what I wrote down. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, I've been a judge 30 years. Every person who's been a judge knows from time to time you get people in front of you charged with criminal acts and you think, this person isn't quite right, but they're just run through the system. 2 years ago, we had 42 people evaluated by psychiatrists to determine if they were competent to enter pleas to the charge. That was 42 people statewide for the whole year. For whatever reasons, that number's tripled in 2 years. Mm-hmm. We were able to handle 42 pretty well. We cannot handle 150, and that's where we're at. I mean, the newspaper articles were very graphic about people having to wait months to enter a plea because they hadn't seen a psychiatrist yet to determine if they were competent to enter that plea. And my idea was, well, we've got a lot of other issues in the criminal justice system other than just that specific narrow issue. Let's get a task force together and let's take a look at the whole big picture. I went to Governor Dugard and he was extremely receptive to it. We sat down and started looking at people we thought would be exemplary members of this task force, and we made 22 phone calls to some of the brightest and best in South Dakota, and we got 22 people to say yes. Not one person turned us down.
Hmm. And so that group is going to get together in the future,
right,
and discuss what?
It'll be a broad-based study about how the criminal justice system deals with folks who come into that system and may have mental health issues. Not just before they enter a plea, but say they're put on probation. I mean, how do you supervise somebody successfully on probation if they have mental illness? Maybe on parole, once again, problems. I mean, system-wide, mental illness has an effect on the people that have been brought into the system.
Now, yesterday when you were mentioning what, studying the problem, proposing solutions, number one thing you mentioned is public safety, mm-hmm. And then some other things after that. But when you said public safety, my mind went to gun violence and mental health issues. Is that part of this discussion at all, to sort of prevent that in this state, or is it a bigger umbrella? It's just any mental health issue? Or
I think it's the big umbrella. There's been no discussion on guns. I mean, the legislature sets that policy. That's not something the courts do.
So it's a bigger sweep,
yep,
than for just anyone who's having
mental health problems. And there are other states that do have various types of successful programs. Florida is kind of the leader in the nation on it, about treating people sooner rather than later that come into the criminal justice system. A lot of them are simply off their meds. If you can get them back on their meds quickly, then they are kind of back to their routine. If they sit and rot in jail for 2 or 3 months, no meds, then you've exacerbated the problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. South Dakota had the second highest incarceration rate of juveniles in the nation, and that is no longer true. Juvenile justice reform, do you want to talk about that?
Well, it's a little premature to declare victory because it just went into effect January 1st. We patterned the process after other states that had successfully done the same thing. The major problem with sending a juvenile to a group home is that you have taken them out of the family, you've taken them out of their town, you put them into a group home. Even if they do well there, there's going to come a day when they come back home. And if the family was part of the problem, we weren't even touching that part of it. So they were right back into the sewer. And so the idea is now, instead of sending all these juveniles to group homes, and they are very expensive. I've seen figures of up to $140,000 a year for one juvenile. Well, let's take that money and let's work with the juvenile in the community and work with the family to see if we can fix the problem there. Less expensive. The juvenile is still in their home area, so it's probably going to work better that way. Stay in their schools and hopefully fix the problem with the family, because actually, it was fairly rare when I was a trial judge to see a juvenile come into my court with a serious problem that there wasn't problems in the family too.
Mm-hmm. So the incarceration rate for juveniles has gone down, and still waiting to see some of the numbers. You said next year you hope to give us a better, you know, indication
right.
of where that was. Has the crime rate for juveniles gone down, or are they just not getting incarcerated?
Well, you know, I don't know the exact figures, but I would say that if it's truancy, why are they being locked up for truancy? I mean, I'm not saying it's good to be a truant or shoplifting. Why are they being locked up for that? Or if they're runaways, why are they being locked up? I mean, you can do better things, less expensive things, and that's what we're looking at.
Thank you so much for joining us. Chief Justice David Gilbertson has been here. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Sure.
That is our show for today. Tomorrow, it's the Tech Radio Guys. I'd like to thank our guests. And from SDPB, thanks Steve Zwemke, Steve Munson, and Jennifer Jones. I'm Lori Walsh. We'll see you back on Dakota Midday on Monday. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, this has been Dakota Midday. Thanks for listening.